I've referred to Steven Pinker frequently throughout our summer series in taking God at his word, and I thought it might be appropriate to do a formal introduction after 8 weeks. So you'll know who he is and why I've used him so often in the course. So from his Wikipedia page, Steven Pinker, he's a man my age. He's a Canadian cognitive psychologist, psycholinguist. His specialty is language. A popular science author and a public intellectual. That establishes his authority, right? And he's put himself out as a public intellectual, so it's legitimate for us to bounce our ideas off of him. He would expect that. Pinker is the Johnstone Family Professor of Psychology at Harvard University. So his authority is backed up by his position, right, as a professor at Harvard University. I think the oldest university, maybe the second oldest in the country. Pinker's book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, here it is right here, posits that violence in human societies has generally declined over time, and he identifies six major trends and forces for explaining this decline. Actually, that was my introduction to Steven Pinker back in 2016. He was offered to me as a rebuttal to the claim that the 20th century was uniquely violent in world history. And turns out, after reading Pinker, I'm convinced it was. The 20th century was uniquely violent in recent world history. But that was my introduction to him. He's written another book, Enlightenment Now, in 2018, further argues that the human condition has generally improved over recent history because of reason, science, and humanism. It has. It's better now than it was at any time in the past. Let's not forget that. We agree on much with Steven Pinker. In 2004, Pinker was named in Time's the 100 most influential people in the world today. So we're not dealing with a minor league intellectual here, okay? He's a major leaguer. The 100 most influential people in the world today. In 2006, he was elected as the Humanist of the Year by the American Humanist Association, okay? Now, this is not humanism like we've been referring to in our discussion of the Enlightenment, focused on the source of human rights. This is humanism defined by the Humanist Manifesto. For example, humans are an integral part of nature, the result of unguided evolutionary change. That's Article 2 from the Humanist Manifesto of 2003, the third Humanist Manifesto. So this is an all-encompassing worldview. Nothing so defined, so focused as what's the source of human rights, which is sort of what we've focused on for the last few weeks, right? So why do I use Steven Pinker? He's a type. In other words, he represents a class or category that share similar characteristics. He's a type of an atheist or a philosophical materialist. We can use Pinker as an example in our discussion of competing worldviews. That's the point. We differ in our premises. For example, I read Article 2 from the Humanist Manifesto. Humans are an integral part of nature, the result of unguided evolutionary change. That's his premise. My premise is found in, say, Genesis chapter 1, verse 27. God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he them, him. Male and female created he them. Distinctly different starting points, okay? So we differ on that. We also differ in our conclusions, okay? Here's my conclusion. It's a great cry of victory. I'm looking at 1 Corinthians 15. And I'm going to start in verse 54. This is the resurrection chapter, right? And so Paul is saying this, so when this corruptible shall have put on incorruption, and this mortal shall have put on immortality, then shall be brought to pass the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is thy sting? O grave, where is thy victory? The sting of death is sin, and the strength of sin is the law. But thanks be to God, which giveth us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. That's the conclusion I've come to. Look at the conclusion that Pinker, as the type of the philosophical materialist, comes to. I'm going to use William Provine as the example. Provine, writing in the journal Origins Research in 1994, said this, "Let me summarize my views on what modern evolutionary biology tells us loud and clear." This may sound familiar, we've heard it before. "There are no gods, no purposes, no goal-directed forces of any kind. There is no life after death. When I die, I am absolutely certain that I am going to be dead. That's it for me." So we start in different places and we end in different places. But along the way, we have much with which over which we agree. We agree on the way things work. Our disagreement lies primarily in the origins and in the conclusions. Okay? Look, Steven Pinker is a really interesting thinker, an engaging writer, and I've learned a great deal from him during my last 9 years since I met him. Well, we want to look at differences. And if we can find big differences, acute differences, they'll be easy to see, right? It's kind of like the call at first base. Some of those are easy calls. Even I could make them. Some of them are pretty close. You watch the top 10 on Sports on ESPN at night, there are some really close calls at first base. In fact, I was having a conversation with Pastor Tim last week. He's all about getting automated calling of balls and strikes and close calls, video replays at first base, right? Because some calls really are close. There are some that are not. And on the origin of life, it's not a close call. So I want to look at that. There's an acute difference between my understanding of the origin of life and Pinker's or understanding of the origin of life. Now, there's really two issues in biological evolution, right? We hinted at them last week. One of them is the origin of life, and the other is the development or the evolution of life once it started, right? And they're two distinct things. We want to make sure we understand that. There's actually a third issue, and that is the operation of life. How does it work? You know, that's one of those things in the middle between origins and conclusions. We mostly agree on how it works. Christian biologists, or biologists with a Christian worldview, and biologists with a evolutionary worldview agree on the chemistry and the physics and the thermodynamics. We can both be good scientists. The operational science is not where the conflict lies. It lies in the origins and in the conclusions. Well, Pinker's worldview is dependent upon three things. We've gone over this before. I just want to go back and use his words. Here's what he says. Entro, evo, info. He's a great writer, so he can summarize concepts in a clever way. Entro, evo, info. Entropy, evolution, information. These concepts define the narrative of human progress. He must force the evidence of nature, reality as he encounters it, into a mold which works with entro, evo, and info. Now, my perspective is different. I view natural laws as descriptive. They describe how God set it up. And my job as an observer is to go out and seek to understand how he did it and follow the evidence. Pinker's point of view is different. He sees natural law as prescriptive. The evidence must follow the law as he sees it. Pinker must force the evidence to fit the rule if he can. And the rule we're looking at today, once again, is entropy and how it impacts biological evolution. So let's just take a quick review of entropy. Entropy is the tendency of an isolated system to go from order to disorder. As we've mentioned in the past, think of a teenager's bedroom. It goes from nicely ordered on Saturday morning so they can get the weekend off to a mess by the following Friday. That's the natural tendency. More scientifically, think of a tray of water with some ice cubes in it. What's going to happen? The ice is, if it's at room temperature, the ice is going to melt, okay? That's the spontaneous process. It would not violate any laws of thermodynamics for the water to become warmer in some places and give that and take that energy from water in other places and have the ice increase, right? You could have more ice form than hotter water over here. That, as long as we account for all the energy, there's nothing to preclude that process. But it never works out that way. The ice always melts. That's because of the entropy. Entropy wants to increase. Disorder, order becomes disorder, okay? Now, just a clarification here. I've always discussed entropy as a qualitative thing. Order to disorder, information to noise, ability to do useful work to loss of ability to do useful work, right? Entropy is actually a quantity that you assign numbers to. Chemists and physicists make calculations using entropy to determine which reactions will go forward, which ones won't, where equilibrium will end up in a chemical reaction. So it's a real thing with real numbers assigned to it. But for our purposes, we're only interested in how it affects the direction of processes. Now, we can lower the entropy of a system by adding energy from an outside source, right? So that tray of ice water, if I stick it in a refrigerator with an ice box, and I plug it in and add energy from an outside source, I can freeze all that water. I can lower the entropy of the system, okay? Using an outside source of energy or work. Pinker and I completely agree on all of those operational issues. We agree on the science. We simply disagree on the origins and the conclusions. This would be a good time to remind ourselves of Isaac Newton, one of the fathers of the scientific revolution, right? So Kepler came along and observed the planets and came up with three laws of planetary motion. Doesn't matter what the particulars are, but they were simply observations and descriptive laws. 100 years later, Newton came along and he developed mathematics and the universal law of gravitation and the laws of motion and was able to derive those observations that Kepler had made. And when he was finished with that, he wrote in Principia, his book, that's his famous book that he wrote, in 1687. Looking at this system, here's what he said. And remember, we're looking at conclusions now, right? This most beautiful system of the sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent being. This being governs all things, not as the soul of the world, but as the Lord over all. And on account of his dominion, he is wont to be called Lord God. So, Newton's conclusion was, what I see and measure as a scientist, the epitome of a scientist, points me right back to God. Okay. Well, let's look at evolution now, and how it relates to entropy. The significance of evolution to Pinker's worldview is similar to Richard Dawkins. We've heard of Richard Dawkins before. Writing in his book, The Blind Watchmaker, 1986, Dawkins says this, "Biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been created." Later, that's page one. By page six, he's saying this, Darwin made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. In other words, the appearance of design is just that. It's just appearance. In reality, Darwin has proved that we don't need a creator. Pinker's foundation is about the same. Here he says in his book, and again, we're using Enlightenment now, says the following, organisms, in other words, living things, organisms are replete with improbable configurations of flesh, like eyes, ears, hearts, and stomachs, which cry out for an explanation. Sound like Dawkins? Before Charles Darwin and Alfred Russel Wallace provided one in 1859, it was reasonable to think that they were the handiwork of a divine designer. Okay, so this is the issue that we're dealing with. Can we replace the designer with evolution? And how does the concept of entropy, on which we all agree, play in this discussion? The question is, does entropy fit with evolution? Paula asked the question a little bit differently. Doesn't entropy push back against evolution? Does it fit? Pinker admits that he has a problem here that he has to deal with. Here's Pinker. At first glance, the law of entropy would seem to allow only a discouraging history and a depressing future. Why? Because everything's running downhill, right? The universe began in a state of low entropy, the Big Bang, with its unfathomably dense concentration of energy. From there, everything went downhill, with the universe dispersing, as it will continue to do, into a thin gruel of particles, evenly and sparsely distributed throughout space. That's a great description, isn't it? This guy is a really good writer. In reality, of course, here's the problem. The evidence, the reality, the universe we find is not a featureless gruel. It is enlivened with galaxies, planets, mountains, clouds, snowflakes, and an efflorescence of flora and fauna, including us. Okay. So this is the evidence we have to account for, okay? In light of the law, the second law of thermodynamics, or entropy. Well, how do we force the evidence to fit the law? Remember, in Pinker's point of view, natural laws are prescriptive. They prescribe what must happen, okay? He's limited in that regard. As a Christian, I'm wide open. God created how he saw fit. My job is to go out and figure out how he did it, right? Okay. Well, how does Pinker do it? Here he says, one reason the cosmos is filled with so much interesting stuff, us, right, complex things, is a process called self-organization, which allows circumscribed zones of order to emerge, okay? Well, what does that really mean? What are circumscribed zones of order? He's saying we're taking systems and we're going to push matter and energy through them, an unlimited amount of matter and energy, and they will self-organize, okay? Now, there are some examples of self-organization. For example, the funnel of a tornado. The eddy at the drain when you unplug the sink, right? The crystalline structure of a snowflake. Okay, so there are some self-organizational properties, but do they explain life? Pinker seems to think so and says so without explanation. His next comment regarding self-organization is this. He posits this concept of self-organization, and with no further discussion, he says this. Once self-organizing processes of physics and chemistry gave rise to a configuration of matter that could replicate itself, then we have Darwinian evolution. What's he saying? He's saying, given self-organization, tornadoes, Then we have self-replicating systems, which he later defines as an organism. So that's his description. It's very much like Darwin's. Remember, Darwin didn't deal with the origin of life. He dealt with the evolution of life from the origin, right? But 12 years after he wrote Evolution of Species, in a letter to Joseph Hooker, he said this. He speculated on the origin of life, because he knew some had to explain the origin of life. And he speculated that in some warm little pond with all sorts of ammonia and phosphoric salts, light, heat, electricity, etc., that a protein compound was chemically formed, ready to undergo still more complex changes. Pinker sounds a lot like Darwin 150 years ago. And in fact, that's the case. On the issues of the origin of life, there's been no progress in understanding the origin of life from a materialist point of view in 150 years. It's possible to refute this notion of self-organization as a mechanism for the origin of life in detail. But really, that's beyond our the scope of this course. It has to do with the fact that these self-organizing systems are always large, macro, okay, tornadoes, whereas life involves organization at the micro level, cells, machines inside cells. And the other principle is that all these self-organizing systems are temporary. They're not permanent. They disperse. How long does the tornado last? 2, 3, 4 hours a day, maybe? Okay. And then it's gone. Nothing persists. So these are some of the basic rebuttals of this notion of self-organization. But rather than spend our time rebutting it, I thought it would be worthwhile just to look at the conclusions of some eminent scientists who have spent their lives studying this issue, mostly atheist scientists. So they would be in the camp of the materialist. So let's look at the conclusions they come to. Now, these conclusions are not specifically toward self-organization. They're addressed to any kind of materialist explanation for the origin of life, okay? So here's Paul Davies. He's an English physicist. He won the Faraday Prize in 2002. That's a big deal. The Faraday Prize is awarded by the British Academy of Science, I think. And he's the chairman of SETI. Anybody know what SETI is? The Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. He's the chairman of SETI. In other words, this guy's got some authority. He's a big deal. Here's what he said in 2003, writing in the International Journal of Astrobiology. As is well known, random molecular shuffling alone is exceedingly unlikely to make even a simple microbe from a planet covered in primordial soup within the age of the universe. So Darwin posited a warm little pond in which life may have originated. Well, Paul Davies, writing in 2003, said, no, even if the entire planet were covered with this primordial soup, this warm little pond, and had the entire age of the universe, which in his mind is going to be about 13 to 14 billion years, we couldn't have even made a small microbe. Naturalistic explanations for the origin of life simply do not work. Francis Crick, we've heard of him before. He lived from 1916 to 2004. You know, people with active minds seem to live longer. All those philosophers we talked about, some of them 90, 95, 100, right? Active body, active mind. Crick is famous for discovering the structure of DNA clear back in 1953. Has it really been 72 years since we discovered the structure of DNA? Writing in a book in 1981, Life Itself, Crick writes this. An honest man, armed with the knowledge available to us now, could only state that in some sense, the origin of life appears at the moment to be almost a miracle. So many are the conditions which would have to be satisfied to get it done. How does Pinker handle it? He posits self-organization. The next statement is, well, once self-organization has provided for an organism, then evolution is up and running, right? No discussion of the details. How about George Wald? George Wald won the Nobel Prize in Medicine or Physiology in 1997. Here's what he has to say in Scientific American. One has only to contemplate the magnitude of this task, which is prebiotic or chemical evolution, the origin of life from non-life. The magnitude of this task, that spontaneous generation of a living organism, is impossible. Once you contemplate the magnitude of the task, you conclude, or at least this Nobel laureate concluded, that spontaneous generation of a living organism is impossible. Why? Because the second law of thermodynamics tells us what spontaneous processes are possible and which ones aren't. And they always go from order to disorder. He keeps on going, though. Yet, here we are. As a result, I believe, of spontaneous generation. That's not science, right? That's faith. Or how about Robert Shapiro? He was a professor of chemistry with a specialization in origins of life research. He wrote a book, Origins, A Skeptic's Guide to the Creation of Life on Earth. And he was particularly criticizing a specific kind of naturalistic evolution. It's called RNA world hypothesis. We won't go into the details of that. But it's another one of the prebiotic chemical evolutionary schemes. How does life arise from non-life? He says this, we desire the best available scientific status report on the origin of life. Well, yeah, that's reasonable. That's what we want. The best available scientific status report on the origin of life. We shall see that adherents of the best-known theory, that's the RNA world hypothesis, have not responded to increasing evidence by questioning the validity of their beliefs. In the best scientific tradition, rather, they have chosen to hold it as a truth beyond question, thereby enshrining it as a mythology. So what Robert Shapiro said is that it's no longer a science. They don't question their beliefs, they enshrine them as a mythology. Okay. This is not science. Finally, one more. We can't quit without talking about Fred Hoyle. Remember him from last summer? A brilliant astrophysicist, did a lot of the developmental work in showing how the elements are generated in stars, stellar nucleosynthesis, they call it. How do we have iron or copper or carbon? Carbon is essential for life. Based upon his studies as a scientist, he predicted that carbon would have a certain energy level called a resonance level. And then he went out and found it, right? So Fred Hoyle, here's what he said. Hey, the chance that higher life forms, he doesn't define what they are, a cell is actually a higher life form because of all the complexity and machinery in it. But he's probably referring to something more than that, perhaps an amoeba. The chance that higher life forms might have emerged in this way, naturalistically, okay, is comparable with the chance that a tornado sweeping through a junkyard might assemble a Boeing 747 from the materials therein. Tornadoes, okay? Self-organization. Tornadoes is a self-organized system. Sweeping through a junkyard, assembling a 747. What's the chance of that? Well, Hoyle says it's the same as the chance that life could arise by purely natural means. Now look, recall we talked about a refrigerator being able to lower the entropy of a system, right? Now, entropy always increases in an isolated system, but I can force the system with outside effort to have the entropy reduced. So we, meaning Pinker and I, agree that a refrigerator can reduce the entropy of a tray of water. We have no disagreement on the operation of it, okay? Where we disagree is on where the refrigerator came from, right? The cell, the organism, can maintain low entropy in its system because it takes outside energy, food maybe, and converts it to useful work inside and maintains low entropy. As soon as that process ends, by the way, what happens? Dust unto dust, right? Entropy takes over and the organism decays into death, right? So we agree that we can pump the system up and maintain low entropy. The question is, what's the origin of the pump? So if I look at a refrigerator, okay, if I encounter a refrigerator, what's my likely first response? That thing was designed by somebody for a purpose, right? Okay, when I see a organism, I see the same thing for the same reason. It's designed for a purpose and it functions, okay? Really, Pinker is left with only one thing to describe the refrigerator, and that would be a that would be a tornado in a junkyard. Okay. Well, I wanted to make a concluding remark on this before we shift to, that was it. You know, Pinker says it's intro, evo, and info, right? Entropy, evolution, and information. I want to turn now briefly to information. We won't finish, but we can make a nice start. Pinker agrees that information is a reduction in entropy. Let me read from his book. Here we go. And now we come to the third keystone. Remember what they were to explain the human condition: entropy, evolution, and information. Now we come to the third keystone, information. Information may be thought of as a reduction in entropy, as the ingredient that distinguishes an orderly, structured system from the vast set of random, useless ones. I want to try to illustrate that with some information. Oh, it's already on. We're good. Okay. Here are 54 characters. The combination of some letters, capital, there's a capital in there somewhere, and there's some spaces, okay? There's just 54 symbols, okay? Arranged randomly. Used a random character, a random number generator to arrange those. That's random. It's complex, but it's also random, okay? What's that?
Where's E and
W? They're not there. I didn't. That would have been my 55th and 56th character. I chose 54. I get to choose because I'm teaching, right? Okay. Let me move this over. Okay. Now, I can add some order to that by grouping all the similar characters together, for example. Okay? There they are. Looks like I chose 5 T's, 1 V. Turns out there are, I think, 9 spaces. There they are. They're all grouped together now. So I've applied some order to that, okay? So the entropy perhaps has gone down because it's more orderly. But remember, our topic is information. Is there any information in either one of those strings of characters? You might be able to infer that there's some similarity. If the symbols look the same, they're have some similarity, but no real information. Well, what if we adjust the characters this way? This is simply another order for those exact same characters, okay? Can you, Alec, can you adjust that so we can see the squigglies? There you go, good, thank you. Okay, so I wanna make some observations. Surprisingly, all three of these, we call them permutations, of those 54 characters are equally likely. If you put them all in a hat and drew them out one at a time and laid them out there, the chance of getting this one or this one or this one are all equally likely. I calculated it. It's two parts in 10 to the 50th. That's a big number. Let's figure out how big it is. The national debt is on the order of trillions, right? Maybe 30 trillion, but we're just going to talk order of magnitude. A trillion is 10 to the 12th, is that right? Check me on it. Millions is 10 to the 6th, billions is 10 to the 9th, trillions is 10 to the 12th. So the national debt is on the order of 10 to the 12th dollars, right? And we all know that's a big debt. The chance of putting these characters into a hat and pulling them out one at a time and getting this sequence or this sequence or this sequence is two parts in 10 to the 50th. Very unlikely, okay? Very unlikely. But look, only one of the sequences conveys information. Even though they're all equally unlikely, only one conveys information. It's this one. Why is that? It's because it coincides, it correlates to a pre-existing specification. We know what the word earth means because it's pre-existed as a concept before we came up with this organization of letters, right? Information requires pre-existing specification of meaning. Pre-existing. In other words, you can't get information just by randomly shuffling symbols. I want you to observe a couple things because my computer confirms that for me. You see the little red underline there? You recognize that if you've done any work on computers. That's spell check or grammar check telling me, John, you've made a mistake. That doesn't correlate with any specified information in the system. It's gibberish, right? Told me that. Okay? And even this ordered one is gibberish, according to the computer, because it knows information must comply with previous prior specification. And it's comparing this string of characters with everything it knows about specified information. Ah, but this one, and I didn't doctor these, this one, there's no squiggly line because it complies with previously specified information and patterns. This is information, okay? I didn't intend that, just the way it worked out. Let's look at one other thing here. You would think that since this has 54 characters, and this one 54, and this one 54, that they'd be the same length. Right? I mean, the same physical length, right? And I struggle with that for a little bit. Why aren't they? Well, it turns out that the spaces here, the computer sees that just as a space, an underscore, okay? And in the printout I made, that's the width there is 5 millimeters because it has no meaning other than it's a space, it's a character. Down here, the space has meaning. The computer recognizes the pattern. Specified pattern, a space between words. So it changed it to comply with the specification. This space right here, I measured them, is only 3 millimeters. So it's shrank all the spaces from 5 millimeters to 3 millimeters because it's information and it complies with a previous specification. So this one is shorter by the difference in the size of the spaces. Notice these two are the same length because neither one is information. Information requires more than order. It requires specification. I think maybe that would be a good place to stop. There were some other things I wanted to say about information. Maybe I'll just wait and say them next week. Let's look at the current, let me ask a question. What is the current status? You know, some of these scientists' quotes on the origin of life are pretty, some of them are 50 and 60 years old, some of them are only 20 years old. What's happened since they wrote those things or made those determinations? Has the situation for the evolutionary worldview, for the philosophical materialist worldview, has it improved? Has it changed? Oh, it's much worse today. It's much worse. New discoveries regularly degrade Darwinism as a valid scientific theory. Let me say that again. New discoveries, since Darwin, regularly degrade Darwinism as a valid scientific theory. We'll look more at that, at the current state of Darwinism, by which I mean philosophical materialism, next week. First, we're going to look at a little more information, but then we're going to sit in on a panel discussion with Steve Meyer, Michael Behe, and John Lennox as they discuss the current state of evolutionary theory and whether or not it is an adequate description of reality as we encounter it. Okay, so that'll be next week. 2 minutes if there's any questions, or you can wait till Wednesday and ask them then. Look at Matthew. He's got a question. I was